From WCAI in Woods Hole and WGBH Radio Boston, this is Living Lab Radio. I'm Heather Goldstone. In the past 2 months, more than 2,300 immigrant children have been separated from their parents after crossing into the U.S. from Mexico. President Trump has issued an executive order ending the practice, but it's not clear when or how the previously separated families will be reunited. And studies suggest that even when they are back together, the children who were detained may suffer mental and physical health problems for years to come, maybe even for the rest of their lives. Joining me now to explain the long-lasting impacts of childhood trauma and what can be done about it is Charles Nelson. He's a professor of pediatrics and neuroscience at Harvard Medical School, professor of education at Harvard University, and the Richard David Scott Chair in Pediatric Developmental Medicine Research at Boston Children's Hospital. Welcome to Living Lab Radio.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
What happens inside a child's brain when they go through something traumatic like being separated from their parents?
Sure. I mean, an answer to that question is a little bit qualified by how old the child is. So let's start with babies and then move up to kids. I think for babies who do not yet have a very well-functioning stress response system, that is, they're not very good at regulating their emotion and dealing with stress because they usually count on their caregivers to do that, we might expect babies to become profoundly distressed, cry for extended periods of time, and of course, like children, will show elevations in their heart rate and their blood pressure and the release of stress hormones. I think the difference between babies and kids is that the babies are going to do a poorer job of regulating their response to stress. On the other hand, for children who will experience the same physiological reactions, release of stress hormones, elevations in blood pressure and heart rate, they too will be very distressed. More concerning for kids, however, is they may have the sort of cognitive capacity to really understand the situation they're in. This is particularly true if they're older than, say, 3 or 4. That is, they realize they're being separated from their parents, and they realize the uncertainty of that they may not know where their parents are, and they may not know where they themselves are going. So that would be an added stressor to a child compared to the baby.
I think we all know that horrible feeling of being alone and afraid and uncertain, and that even just as you describe it, right, the elevated heart rate, the physiological feeling in your body at that point. What happens, especially for children, to turn that kind of potentially short, acute experience into something much longer lasting?
Right. So that's the thing we're most worried about. So the acute phase, the question is, how does that become transformed into some long-lasting harm? And I think, you know, the qualifiers there would be how long the child is in that situation. Something that we're not spending much time talking about in the public is the history these children have. So if they fled a region of the world where there's high levels of violence already, and they come with some pre-existing trauma, that will make them even more vulnerable to this separation at the border. And of course, then there's the long, arduous journey that took them to the border, which could also have been very stressful. So those things combined sort of conspire against the child when they're separated. And I think the worry we have is that the separation will, the longer it goes on, the greater the release of these stress hormones, which have targets in the brain, meaning that there are certain parts of the brain that are particularly sensitive to these hormones, including those that deal with learning and memory, those that deal with emotion regulation and the like. We should start to see changes probably inside of weeks, and then those physiological changes will start to manifest in behavioral changes. So that could include, depending on the age of the child, heightened anxiety, maybe depression. And in some cases, it can also lead to kids becoming disruptive as well.
I want to go back to something you said about the history, the pre-existing trauma that many of these children may have faced. How does one traumatic event then make the effects of subsequent other stressful or traumatic events heightened?
That's a, you know, it's an excellent question that scientists have been puzzling over for some time. Think of it as a form of sensitization. So think of it as the inverse of a vaccination, which protects you. Here we have a situation where the brain becomes sensitized to these stressful experiences. And in so being, it becomes, in a sense, vigilant, waiting for the next one to come along, and they accumulate. So what that means is that a child with a pre-existing history of trauma, having come from a violent neighborhood or something like that, may already be, in a sense, more vulnerable to when this happens again. And then the question is, how many times can they experience this before we see lasting harm? And I think the classic example of that are children who experience maltreatment that occurs over and over and over again, such as sexual abuse. So in this case, what we have to be concerned about are kids, if they already have a history here, they're more likely to be sensitive or vulnerable to having an even more deleterious response to the separation.
You've already mentioned some of the psychological or cognitive effects that can have long-term ramifications about anxiety and learning problems. But these can also, in addition to that, we're learning childhood trauma can result in higher rates of chronic diseases and susceptibility to some of the most common causes of death, to even early death. Do we understand how a psychologically traumatic event in childhood translates into physical and physiological ailments in adulthood?
Sure. So let's begin with a concept called allostatic load. This is something that Bruce McEwen at Rockefeller has been championing for some time. And what that means is it's sort of the chronic wear and tear on the body of chronic elevations in these stress hormones. And what that can do is it can affect blood vessels. It can clearly affect the brain. And over time, what it seems to do is weaken the immune system, increase the risk for cardiovascular disease and diabetes. And we've known this for, you know, for quite some time now, that multiple forms of adversity early in life lead not just to psychological sequelae, but also biological and physical sequelae. The question is, how long can these kids sustain their current circumstances before these things become biologically embedded and get translated into physiological, permanent physiological changes? On the short term, we probably expect these kids to already show sleep disturbances. One report I heard is that they're leaving the lights on in some of these detention centers 24 hours a day. So we know that's going to dysregulate their circadian clock, and it's going to dysregulate sleep. Kids need sleep. Disturbances in sleep will lead to other wear and tear in the body. So collectively, we think that these chronic stressful experiences, in this case brought about by the separation, will likely lead to physiological changes. And then the question is, will they lead to long-term changes in health?
So you think it's a question still at this point as to whether or not this kind of event would lead to long-term health problems for many of these children?
Right. And I think, you know, the jury is out in terms of how long this will go on. I mean, having looked into this a little bit before our call, I can't get a good sense of how long these separations will continue. I heard this morning that several hundred kids have been found in New York City that the mayor didn't know about, including, I think, a nine-month-old that is there by him or herself. And so we don't know this issue of duration. Will 3 weeks of separation be sufficient to cause long-term damage, or does it need to be longer? The reports I've heard, however, is that even with this executive order, the 2,300-plus kids that are now separated, it could be quite some time before they're reunited with their parents. So I think we need to be alert to this, and I think when the kids are the kids' health, physical and psychological, needs to be monitored by authorities right now, actually, and then continued after the reunion occurs.
My guest is Charles Nelson of Harvard University. We are talking about the long-term psychological and physiological impacts of childhood trauma. Obviously, scientists could never get permission to do an experiment that involves subjecting children to trauma and then following them over the course of their lifetime to learn about the long-term effects. So how do we know what we know at this point about the long-term impacts of childhood trauma?
Sure. There are two pathways that scientists have gone down to study that very question. First, it's studies looking at kids with documented cases of, say, maltreatment. And there's a long literature here looking at kids who experience maltreatment at different ages. And we know both that the brain effects are determined in part by the age of the child when the abuse or neglect occurs and the duration of that. But the other thing we know a lot about neglect. And that is, a concern from what I've been seeing about these kids right now. So two colleagues of mine, Nathan Fox and Charlie Zina, have for nearly 18 years been studying a group of children in Romania who were abandoned by their parents, in other words, separated from their parents, and then raised in state-run institutions. And this will sound terrible, but the institutions we've studied in Romania bear some resemblance to the videos I'm seeing of these detention centers in places like Texas. So we know from that study, which is actually a randomized controlled trial, so we started with a large group of kids who were abandoned to institutions, we studied them, and then half of them were placed in foster care that we had to build because there was no government foster care, and half remained in institutional care. And those kids have been followed for the really almost two decades of life. So we know the profound effects that neglect has based on that study, for example. And we know that neglect leads to a whole series of changes in the child's psychological makeup, their neurological makeup, and their physical makeup. The children who were removed at the youngest ages and put into families show the greatest recovery.
That leads to my next question, which is that reuniting these families, as you've said, we don't know when that might happen, but that doesn't necessarily undo the trauma of the separation that's already occurred. What can be done in terms of interventions or actions to actually try to reduce and prevent some of those longer-term impacts that we've been talking about?
So the question that I've been giving a great deal of thought to is what to expect in terms of these children's post-separation recovery. So once they're reunited with their families, what should we expect? And I think there's two approaches there. There's the interventions that we can implement after they've been reunited with their families. And clearly that will be of a psychological nature primarily, that is having mental health experts in there to assess the kids and then to provide treatment. Probably they should also have a physical examination to make sure that there's no physical effects. But there might be a preventative intervention as well. And this is the other thing that I'm concerned about, which is while these kids are in the detention center, that will have a great bearing over their recovery. So if, for example, the children were placed in loving foster care of families that took good care of them, I'd be much less concerned than what appears to be these congregate care settings of putting all these kids in a fenced-in area. And I think that one way or the other, the mental health needs and the physical needs, of course, of these kids needs to be closely monitored now. And any child showing any sign of distress, for example, anxiety, depression, what have you, they need to do an intervention now. And the sooner they deal with that now, the more likely the child is to respond favorably when they've been reunited with their family and then get further treatment.
REVEAL and the Center for Investigative Reporting have released an investigation that they've conducted showing evidence that children in some of these, you know, detention centers going back before this latest wave in May and June have been treated with a number of psychiatric drugs to deal with exactly the kinds of behaviors that you were talking about, whether that's depression or anxiety or actually acting out and becoming aggressive. What are the potential long-term ramifications of that?
Well, so that's the first I've heard of this, and that's very disturbing. And in fact, it reminds me of my first trips to Romanian orphanages when often the drug you saw most often in the wards was phenobarbital, or Haldol, the drugs that are used to sedate kids and keep them quiet and keep them well behaved. So I had no idea they were doing that. I think that there are two issues there. One is that is not the way to treat kids' behavior and emotion problems. Whatever problems these kids are having now, we should expect it to be almost a direct outgrowth of the separation and where they're being held, not some underlying problem that needs to be treated that has nothing to do with the separation. So the concern is, first, are these medications being used appropriately? That is, has someone prescribed these for very specific problems, like attention deficit disorder, depression, and the like? But the second issue is, for behavioral emotional issues in these children, medication may not be the approach to take. It's certainly the cheapest and the easiest, but the concern is taking a developing brain and exposing it to drugs that may well have deleterious effects. And the classic example would be powerful antipsychotics used to control emotional outbursts, for example, and behavior dysregulation in a very young developing brain. So those drugs, if used on a long-term basis, they themselves could contribute to bad developmental outcomes in these kids.
Charles Nelson is a professor of pediatrics and neuroscience at Harvard Medical School, professor of education at Harvard University, and Richard David Scott Chair in Pediatric Developmental Medicine Research at Boston's Children's Hospital. Thank you so much for speaking with us.
It's been my pleasure. Thanks for calling.
Up next, how smart are sharks? Living Lab Radio continues after a short break.